Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Now on BBC World Service, it's time for a new programme where the past sheds light on recent events. Here's George Arney with Timeline.
Welcome to Timeline, a new programme in which we'll be using archive as a historical starting point from which to get a clearer perspective, perhaps, on some of today's key issues. This week's subject, very apt in view of the recent tragedy in India, is the phenomenon of urban terrorism. The carnage which has just been perpetrated in the city of Mumbai serves as a sharp reminder that in 2008, urban terrorism is still very much a phenomenon to be reckoned with. But what can be learned by examining the terror groups and terrorist activities of the past? The Baader-Meinhof gang was a radical left-wing urban guerrilla group which seized the imagination of West Germany and the world in the early 1970s. Its legacy still hasn't entirely disappeared. A German court just recently approved the release from jail of a leading member, Christian Klar. During the 1970s and 80s, the group, officially known as the Red Army faction, was responsible for a string of high-profile robberies, kidnaps, bombings and killings.
This is Sender Freies Berlin with a news flash.
The 86 hostages hijacked by terrorists.
The Red Army faction was formed soon after what was intended to be a peaceful political protest got out of hand.
A demonstration had been arranged to protest against the visit to Germany by the Shah of Iran. The police began to break it up, and in the struggle that followed, one of the demonstrators, Benno Ohnesberg, was shot dead.
The death of the young demonstrator, shot in the head by a police officer, persuaded the high school dropout Andreas Baader to confront what he saw as the fascist German authorities head on. Then on the 1st of June 1972, Baader was captured with two accomplices, Jan-Karl Rasper and Holger Mainz. By chance, the action was captured by a cameraman on his way to work. Bodo Kindermann, the chief inspector of Frankfurt Police, explained what happened.
One morning, Baader and Mainz drove up in a Porsche. At first, we tried to persuade the terrorists to give up. Then we ordered up an armoured vehicle. Baader was very cool. He fired five shots from his 9mm and shot up the armoured car completely. Then I gave orders for a sharpshooter. He fired a high-velocity bullet. This hit Baader in the thigh. He screamed like a pig.
Despite the arrest of Baader and other gang leaders and their conviction for murder, the attacks continued, including, in 1977, the abduction and eventual murder of one of Germany's leading industrialists, former SS officer Hans-Martin Schleyer.
After 43 days, we have ended Hans-Martin Schleyer's pathetic and corrupt existence. Chancellor Schmidt can pick him up from a green Audi 100 parked in Mühlhausen.
With the news dominated by the group's activities, by 1977, the whole of West Germany was on high alert.
Armoured cars patrol in Bonn, target ministries are protected, politicians' homes festooned with barbed wire. Terrorism has sorely tested the nation's will. By forcing the state to defend itself, Baader-Meinhof and terrorist associates have sought to make the practice of democracy unconvincing.
Well, that archive provides a good reminder of just how seriously the Red Army faction was taken by the German authorities, and also of the media attention which they commanded. In fact, at one time, the German news magazine Der Spiegel ran a weekly column on the activities of the Baader-Meinhof gang. At a time when events in Mumbai have once again thrust the issue of terrorism back into the forefront of the world's attention, we'll be considering, in today's timeline, whether the activities of the Red Army faction mark the start of a new era, an era in which the media profile achieved by the terrorists is one of their primary aims. To discuss that, Timeline has a series of guests lined up, the first of whom is Richard Huffman, a Seattle-based writer who's devoted the past 10 years to documenting the activities of the Baader-Meinhof gang. You and your family, Richard, I think I'm right in saying, moved to Berlin just a few weeks after Andreas Baader was busted out of prison and the gang was formed. Is that how you got interested in it?
Yeah, my dad was in the U.S. Army and he was the bomb disposal technician. And over the next couple of years, my dad defused about 7 different bombs left by left-wing urban guerrillas in and around Berlin, including one that was left where my mom was having lunch, one that was left specifically designed to kill my dad and his crew.
Well, you've since done a great deal of research. What sort of people joined the Baader-Meinhof gang and where did they draw their inspiration from?
It's a somewhat accurate truism that most of the people that joined the Baader-Meinhof group and groups like this were young, basically students. Their goal was global revolution, and they believed that their job was to not fight the war, but be the vanguard of a war against fascism that they saw was hidden in German society. And they felt that if they fought this hidden fascism, the fascist state would rise up and try to crush them with such overwhelming power that the German people would themselves spontaneously rise up and fight them. It seems kind of crazy, but that's exactly what they thought would happen.
Just sketch in the political context out of which the group emerged, would you? Because not only was the German state of the time authoritarian, but internationally it was a very politically turbulent time, wasn't it?
It was. The Baader-Meinhof group felt that they were fighting, they were opening a front of the Vietnam War in Germany. They thought that the Vietnam War was an imperialist war that needed to be fought across the globe. They believed that they were bringing the war home to the American people and then their German puppets that supported them.
And of course, it was all coming just a few years after the great student upheavals of 1968. Now, you've mentioned how students were the core members of Baader-Meinhof, and the strong support felt by a section of West German youth at the time for the group comes over very strongly in this news report.
These people admired the way the Baader-Meinhof group had taken up the challenge to society, and they organized themselves to help them. If the group were at the top of the pyramid, then these people are the base. Thousands who, though they wouldn't necessarily let off a bomb themselves, are sympathetic to those who do.
All around the world, it was a time of heightened youth radicalism. And reports from that time in the mainstream German media made a deliberate connection between young people who'd chosen an alternative lifestyle and groups like Baader-Meinhof.
The words and the music are anti-authoritarian, anti-society. This isn't the sound of protest, it's the sound of revolution.
If many young people were drawn to the group and if the media were fascinated by it, the German state also helped to blow it out of proportion. A special prison was built to house the captured outlaws, and the courtroom even had its windows bricked up to stop rescue efforts.
In this remarkable concrete and steel fortress on the outskirts of Stuttgart, West Germany, four members of the so-called Baader-Meinhof group went on trial this week, charged with a formidable range of offences. Nowhere in the Western world has there been anything quite like the security surrounding the court, nor like the building itself, with its anti-helicopter defences, its underground listening devices, and its constant closed-circuit television.
So, the German state clearly very shaken by the Red Army faction, but Richard Huffman, how far did the size and the reach of the group actually justify this major reputation that it managed to build for itself?
Well, ironically, if you were to look at just the number of actions that they accomplished, their impact was actually relatively small when you compare it to the amount of attacks, say, the Red Brigades did in Italy and other left-wing German terror groups such as the Revolutionary Cells in Germany. It was mostly a matter of how prominent they were in the public's mind that led to this belief that Germany was collapsing under the weight of these youth that were turning on us. The reality was, I believe, considerably less so.
So tell us about the prominence that they had in the public mind. It's your thesis that the Baader-Meinhof group were the first real modern terrorists. What do you mean by that?
Well, in a sense, they were celebrity terrorists. And I don't mean that in a positive sense. I mean that in a sense that it was personality driven. We knew of the names of members as opposed to other groups where it was just an ideology. People in Germany knew of Ulrike Meinhof. They saw her on TV. They knew of Andreas Bader. They thought of them differently. And it taught, I think, future generations of other terrorist groups the importance of media and of getting people to understand you as individuals. I think Osama bin Laden is, in a sense, the natural result of what the Bader-Meinhof group created.
Well, at this point, let me bring in Timeline's second guest, Dr. Richard Jackson, reader in international politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales. Do you agree, Dr. Jackson, that Bader-Meinhof can claim to be the first modern terrorist?
Well, I'm not really sure about the claim to being the first modern terrorist, because particularly within the field of terrorism studies, quite a lot of scholars actually point to the Palestinian groups who started hijacking as a tactic. And we had in 1968 the El Al hijacking, where they took the plane to Algeria, I think it was. And then within a few years, we had 30 or 40 more hijackings. And so it's probably debatable which group can claim to be the first modern terrorists. Going back to something that Richard Hoffman said, I think he's absolutely right, in that what we began to see from 1968 was the key role played by the media in constructing them as a kind of celebrity terrorism. And in a way, modern terrorism, I would argue, is a creation of the international media, because the coverage given to them didn't just construct them as these kind of Robin Hood type figures in the popular imagination, but also gave publicity to the methods, the strategies, the ideologies, the tactics that these groups were engaging in. And in that way, it kind of spread to other conflict areas, who then realized what the advantages of international media coverage would be.
You seem, Richard Jackson, almost to be blaming the media for the phenomenon which terrorist groups began. Was it a change in operating procedures by the media, or was it simply the global reach of the media itself moving towards what we have now, 24-hour news cycle, which enabled them to spread what terrorists were doing?
The media makes choices about the kinds of terrorist actions or violent actions that they are going to give airtime to. And I would argue, for example, that the whole reason why the Mumbai attackers deliberately targeted Westerners was because they knew for a fact that killing Westerners would get them more international media coverage, particularly from Western organizations, than if they limited their targets to local Indians. And I think the point is that terrorists have exploited this, but the media can't be blameless in the way that they have covered and in some ways therefore encouraged other groups to copy these original groups to try and gain the same kind of publicity.
Well, let's just illustrate some of the points you've been making. In 1970, Palestinian militants staged what became known as Skyjack Sunday. Three separate aircraft hijacked and forced to fly to Dawson Field in Jordan. A fourth group attempted to hijack an El Al Boeing over London, but they were foiled by security staff. The two hijackers on board that flight, one female, one male, were noticed just before takeoff by a fellow passenger.
We were in the air, sailing smoothly, I was reading, and then suddenly he rose and he let out a bellow, an animal-like bellow, and he had this little tiny pistol in his hand. And she ran after him, and the two of them were behind the curtains into first class, and then we heard some shots that sounded like cap pistol shots, but apparently it was more than that.
What happened
when
the plane came in to land at London Airport?
Well, by that time, of course, they were both immobilized.
We heard they were singing on board.
They were singing on board Hebrew songs and keeping everybody's spirits up, and they really did a remarkable job in keeping everybody contained and not panicking.
But if terrorists were using the media to publicise their cause, the media were also often guilty of glamorising or mythologising the terrorists. Listen to this news clip from December 1975. 11 oil ministers and 59 civilians were being held hostage after a meeting of the oil cartel OPEC in Vienna had been stormed by a Venezuelan dubbed by the media Carlos the Jackal.
Throughout a night of freezing temperatures, armed police maintained a tight cordon round the office building where the hostages and their captors waited for the terrorist deadline, 7 a.m. At precisely that time, a bus was moved into position at a side door, and at 7:25, the hostages began boarding. A terrorist in a white raincoat was clearly running things. He's the man suspected by some of being the much-wanted Venezuelan, Carlos Martinez, known as the Jackal.
Tell us a little bit more, if you would, Richard Jackson, about Carlos the Jackal, because in some senses, he, or at least his name, was a media creation.
Absolutely. He is a perfect example of the media constructing a myth of a lone wolf kind of terrorist terrorizing the world and having some kind of superpowers, like some kind of super agent. What we saw was an extraordinary set of myths that followed him all the way around the world. And if you actually trace the media reporting about him, there were moments when he was actually in about five different countries on the same day. And so a lot of what was actually written about him by the media was myth. But the point is that it constructed him, it created him as this mythical terrorist archetype. In many ways, bin Laden is a similar creation following in the same line.
Well, this is a good place to bring in our final guest this week on Timeline, Matthew Carr, whose book, The Infernal Machine, A History of Terrorism, places the leading terrorist organisations of the past century in context. Is there, Matthew Carr, a direct line of evolution of terrorism from the early bomb throwers, which is what I guess the Infernal Machine refers to, through the left-wing radicals of the 70s, the Carlos the Jackals, and on to the terrorists who carried out 9/11 and the attacks in Mumbai?
It is possible to trace a certain continuity between, for example, the Russian groups that assassinated Tsar Alexander II in 1881, because they created this very romantic image of small vanguard terrorism, the idea that a small group could take on even a powerful autocracy like the Tsarist regime and even kill its most powerful symbolic representative. So, yes, there is a line of continuity between the so-called technique of terrorism, which is basically consists of trying to provoke a more powerful enemy into an overreaction.
We've been talking about the mythologizing of terrorists. Do you agree that that does go on, and what are the dangers of it?
There's often been a kind of mythologizing of terrorism right back to the 19th century, when anarchist bombers were kind of imagined as these kind of absolutely dangerous nihilist killers with the power to kind of bring down whole societies with these devious devices, these infernal machines, as the bombs were called. There's often been a tendency on one side to romanticize this kind of violence by the people who might support it, and on the other side to demonize it to the extent that it seems to be more powerful than it actually is. And this is a recurring trend you can see in movement after movement.
Richard Jackson?
I think we have to actually be a little more nuanced here about what we mean by mythologized, because I would argue that terrorists are mythologized, but in a way that actually demonizes them. And what we actually mythologize about them is, for example, their power to disrupt our society and their evil intentions and their lack of any political motive and the fact that they may be a little bit crazy or abnormal. But on the whole, terrorists are considered evil. They're considered outside of the community. They're considered animals, savages. That's where the key dangerous kind of mythologizing comes in my mind, because governments then use that mythology to justify ever more intrusive means of fighting terrorism.
There's this good quote I thought I saw while researching this: the terrorist's action must always be complemented by the target's reaction in order to complete the scene. Is that a continuing aim of terrorist groups?
I think they can be, really, and I think, I don't know, it's too early to tell at the moment exactly what the political motives, the strategic intentions of these this horrendous atrocity in Mumbai is. But one thing we can assume straight away is that it was intended to provoke an overreaction. So therefore, yes, I think we have to be much more careful about when we look at terrorism, when instead of trying to kind of turn these people into monsters and imagine them as glamorous celebrities, we have to actually look very concretely at the political context that gives rise to them and try and understand them on their own terms. That doesn't mean we have to like them, by the way.
OK, well, as we come to the end of this edition of Timeline, let's just return to the Baader-Meinhof group and drop in a final bit of audio archive taken from the time of the death in prison of Andreas Baader and two of his fellow gang members, including his girlfriend Gudrun Enslin.
The corpse of Andreas Baader lies almost in the middle of the room, between the mattress and the bookshelf.
The corpse of Gudrun Enslin. It's not quite hanging in the center of the window, but somewhat to the right.
Several hundred police took up positions around the cemetery for this morning's funeral, but nobody was taking any chances. Most faces were covered, heads averted. The mood was sullen and resentful. Well over 1,000 people had come to mourn the death by suicide of three of the most fanatical and ruthless extremists in Europe. It was not helped by at least 200 members of the world's press fighting for position at the graveside.
So the media attention continued to the bitter end. But what about those deaths, Richard Jackson? How important would you say that final outcome, death or martyrdom, is for the process of mythologizing terrorists?
Well, I suppose it is pretty important for future generations of terrorists. And what that says to the other members of the group is, I'm willing to die for this. Are you willing to go as far as that as well? And so there is a powerful symbolic aspect to martyrdom and to giving your life to the cause. And I think that in part the media sort of plays into that and actually helps the terrorist groups along with that particular message.
Matthew Carr.
There's often a suicidal element connected with revolutionary terrorism. This willingness to die yourself is often used as a justification for the willingness to kill, because terrorists are often accused by armies of carrying out a form of violence that is not military, that does not follow the rules of war, and so on. Many of the people in these groups are aware of this themselves. So one of the ways they rationalise what they do to themselves is by saying, well, we're willing to give up our lives, therefore we can kill.
Well, as we've heard so tragically recently, terrorism continues, but not particularly in Germany. And 30 years or so on, Richard Huffman, I'm wondering what's happened to the popular support that Baader-Meinhof enjoyed back in the early 70s? I mean, violent left-wing revolutionaries wouldn't win much support in Germany these days, would they?
Well, there isn't any support in Germany for left-wing terrorism, but a lot of the initial people that supported it early on, they had basically two choices to go. Do we want to support this type, or do we want to take what Rudi Dutschke, the famous left-wing firebrand, called the long march through the institutions? And a lot of them chose that path. They became Greens several years ago. These were the people that ended up coming into power in the red-green coalition. So a lot of them chose that path, and ultimately they were a lot more successful in changing German society.
Well, thank you to all my guests, Richard Huffman, Dr. Richard Jackson, and Matthew Carr. I'm George Arney, and Timeline will be back next week.
Timeline was presented by George Arney and produced by Kevin Dawson. It was a Whistledown production for BBC World Service.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.